The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back.
Yeah, well, welcome back, Peter. So you're an international traveler. I don't know too many of those, so it's pretty exciting to be hanging out with you.
Yeah, there's not a lot these days, but yes, I'm back from the UK where I spent the better part of a month, and it was a great trip, but not without excitement.
Yeah, well, I saw your tweet about the BP fuel station that said, sorry, we're out of fuel. Our teams are working hard to fix this, so I hope you weren't walking around the UK.
Well, we were actually walking for most of the time, but we did rent a car for about a week. And for the first few days, it was fine. We're touring around. And then what happened was that I saw a Bloomberg News article one late afternoon, and it was talking about some shortages at some fuel stations. And I thought, that's not good. Maybe I ought to just fill up. But I said, it'd be kind of okay. And then that evening, every single news outlet on television and newspapers that were coming out and headlines were about fuel shortages. And I knew, just based on all the work that we do, that this was probably going to cause a run on gasoline and diesel, and there's going to be queues and hoarding and so on. And sure enough, that's what happened. So I got up really early the next morning, went to the nearest gas station and filled up before that happened. Then when we had to return the vehicle with a full tank, it was hard to find a station that wasn't empty. And when we did find one, they were rationing fuel to 30 pounds, pounds as in British pounds. And so it was still going on by the time we got back. But they're easing the situation. But, you know, there's a lot of lessons to be learned out of this in terms of some of the things we're talking about, in terms of how vulnerable our supply chains are, including our energy supply chains, to externalities.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about that. We'll be talking today. Well, we're going to start with the Canadian election quickly. Short, because there's not that much to say on that, but we will talk a little bit about it.
Yep.
But then we want to focus what's happening in Europe, more with the natural gas situation.
Yeah.
But also, I think the petrol situation has a lot of lessons in it too. So we'll finish with some lessons to be taken from the whole situation over there. Okay, well, Canadian election while you were gone, Peter, you may feel like you didn't go anywhere because pretty much the government looks exactly the same.
Yeah.
A few seats have changed, but generally it's a Liberal minority. Conservatives have almost the same number of seats. Liberals still need the NDP or Bloc on their side to pass legislation. Now, that worked pretty well for the Liberals. In fact, you could argue they operated almost like a majority in that they were able to pass the legislation that they wanted with the NDP's
consent.
Support.
Yeah, support.
But we'll see if things change. At the end, the campaign got pretty heated and a lot of things were said. So I hope that the parties will see if they can still cooperate like they were before.
Right. So what are the differences in the Liberal climate plan pre-election versus post-election, or post-election versus pre?
Right. Well, in what to expect from the Liberals now, I think they're going to push forward all those policies we've talked about on the podcast, the big name policies like the Canadian Clean Fuel Standard, the carbon price to $170 by 2030, their net zero to 2050 plans, including these five-year plans, tax credits, support for EVs. What was new, though, in the platform, and it's still uncertain if these are going to rise to the top of the agenda here, but there were plans to cut methane emissions by 75% from the oil and gas sector and also the broader economy. Before it was 40 to 45% by 2025. So now it's 75 by 2030. So greater ambition for methane.
And there was stuff on the electricity grid too, wasn't there?
Yes. Yeah. So they have a plan to get a net zero grid by 2035 in Canada. And there was also some discussion around a pan-Canadian grid to promote grid infrastructure and basically create a east to west grid in Canada. And we talked about that with Scott from AltaLink on our podcast and how the importance of creating those interconnections because it can increase resiliency. And so it was interesting to see that. I haven't really seen too much discussion of that before.
I mean, in Canada, creating a net zero electricity grid is probably one of the easiest things to do, certainly relative to other countries, because we're dominantly hydro. And in places like Alberta, we used to be coal heavy, but it looks like we're probably going to be coal free by, I'm hearing numbers like as early as 2026. We do have natural gas fired stuff. But generally speaking, to get a net zero electricity grid in Canada is really quite achievable. Now, getting a pan-Canadian grid is a whole separate issue with all the interprovincial politics and issues.
Yeah, and it is definitely getting into provincial territory there, but I think it makes a lot of sense. Like, for example, can you imagine we have a lot of renewables here in Western Canada, and they're backed up by hydro in BC and Manitoba?
Right.
It would make a lot of sense. So it's the first time I've really seen that in a platform that I'm aware of. So we'll see what happens there. There's even a discussion of a grid council being put together.
Mm-hmm.
There was also some discussion of additional tax credits for renewable energy and battery storage.
Yep.
I don't know for sure what that means, but maybe that means something like the U.S. tax credit that helps solar and wind. They get about 30% right. off their capital cost.
And what about the carbon capture? I know that's a big issue for the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, so I think that there was actually a call for feedback on that, and that was due in early September. So we'll hear about that, I'm sure, now that the Liberals are in. I'm expecting that will go forward. We just don't know how much and what exactly it looks like, but that'll be important.
It'll be important. I mean, CCS. A lot of people associate CCS with extending the longevity of the oil and gas industry. But I mean, CCS is going to be essential for decentralized emitters, thinking like agriculture, aviation, and other heavy industrial emitters that are going to take a long time to switch over. I mean, they're going to have to figure out ways of capturing their emissions or offsetting them, and sort of director capture, for example, and sequestering it in an underground. And who knows underground better than the oil and gas industry and how to drill a hole and put the stuff down there? So it's happening in Texas, right?
It is, yeah. And generally, the U.S. has stronger policy than us right now. Mm-hmm. So I think this will be a pretty important policy to start to see some investment come into Canada. So we'll wait and see. It really depends on what it looks like and how much credit you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
But I think now that the Liberals are in with the minority government, we should see something on that.
So basically, it's the same agenda as before the election, maybe with more commitment from the Liberals to these targets and goals, a little bit of tightening up on some of the things like methane. But for the most part, it's steer the course, would you say?
Yeah. I mean, there were these new items, which were, I think, to address the fact that a lot of those policies that the government was working on before were to get to a 30% reduction by 2030. And now the Liberal government has upped it to a 40 to 45%. So I think some of these new initiatives are focused on trying to get that greater reduction by 2030. And that's going to be quite a challenge. So we'll probably see more on that. I think these net zero goals and that sort of thing are going to be part of that as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens. Just because these things are listed in the platform document doesn't mean necessarily that they happen.
And how they happen over time and how it all gets paid for and so on is super important. And I think there's some lessons that can be learned from that European situation in terms of what we can learn and some of the issues that can be avoided, because arguably the Europeans have been ahead with some of these agenda items that are being talked about.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's talk about Europe then.
Sure.
So let's talk about the natural gas situation. Some are calling it an energy crisis, very high energy prices there. And the interesting thing is this example really reminds us how connected our energy markets are. You know, something happens in Europe and all these knock-on impacts happen to Asia and North America and to other fuel types. So just to kind of give people a overview of what's happened, in the 2021 winter and early spring, it was quite cold in Europe. And that resulted in them drawing down their inventories of natural gas. Now, those didn't replenish this summer as they typically do. And one reason was there was a constraint on LNG imports. Asia was demanding more LNG, but also some of the suppliers were not providing as much gas as they typically did. So, for example, some of the LNG facilities weren't operating at full capacity in like Nigeria and Trinidad and Tobago, Norway. There's a whole list of countries that weren't fully operating their LNG facilities for a variety of issues, some of it a lack of investment, some of it maintenance issues. And then the Russian gas, which usually increases when there's higher prices, didn't. And so here we are going into winter in Europe with very low storage and a view that supply just isn't responding to these high prices. And so that's caused prices to go up about five times since early 2021. So now, believe it or not, it's about $25 per MMBTU for gas in Europe.
Yeah.
So that's crazy. Typical prices are
like
five.
Let's put that in perspective. It was $5 per MMBTU, $5 per MMBTU. It's now 25. Here right now, the prices are four.
$4. At Henry Hub, we have prices between $5 and $6, depending on the day right now. Right.
And AECO is around $4-ish, right?
Yes.
Right. So we still have the benefit of having our own domestic natural gas, but that may not hold. There's expectations that if Europe has a cold winter, that the price of natural gas here will rise fairly aggressively as well.
Right, because it may be that we are sending a lot of LNG exports out of the U.S. right now. About 10% of the consumption of natural gas in the U.S. right now is for these LNG exports at about 10 BCF per day. And if Europe needs a lot of gas, it's fine if it's just 10 BCF per day. But let's say we don't want all those exports to go out because North America needs them. Mm-hmm. Then you'll have to compete with those other markets. And you may see prices get quite high here for a time.
I think it's important for our listeners to recognize two big dynamics that have changed even in the last short while. So the first one is that North America is no longer a natural gas, I'll call it an island, because we were an interconnected grid of natural gas between Canada and the U.S. There was no LNG export capability. And so the prices were all set here locally, depending largely upon the weather, hot or cold, depending on summer, winter, and so on. But with the opening up of LNG in the last few years, all of a sudden we are now participating in international markets, international competition. And as more LNG trains are opened up, I think there's another two coming online, right, in the Gulf Coast here in the short while.
Yes, that's right.
And so we are likely to see even more internationalization of our natural gas, meaning we will be competing on the world stage, or our prices here will be responding to what happens on the world stage with natural gas. The second dynamic, which we're well aware of, has been the sort of the directive with the whole ESG and divestment movement and so on our domestic oil and gas industry, basically not to grow production and certainly not of oil, because we know that natural gas is commingled with oil. The natural gas supply has not been growing as fast as it has in the past. In fact, I think it's been down a little bit. And so all of a sudden, we don't have as much gas as we used to. The international markets are demanding more. And therefore, that is all very robust for the price of natural gas.
Yeah, we're just not seeing this. You know, in North America, we've had these quite high prices now for quite a while, several months. And we're just not seeing that supply response. That's a different dynamic as well. Now, I want to quickly talk about, all the knock-on effects. This high natural gas price not only caused prices to go up here in North America, not as high as Europe yet, but higher than they had been. But in Asia, we've seen very high prices as well. And that's resulted in problems there, and not only high prices, but also shortages where they've had to cut back some of their power consumption.
Like in China, there's some serious power outages.
Yep.
And that's really affecting economic activity. I mean, $23 is just a huge price for natural gas.
Yeah. I mean, it would be this equivalent of people paying 5 or 6 times more for their heating bill, and it's going to affect power prices. Now, here's talk about the knock-on effects. It's also affected the carbon prices in Europe because as more people have seen these high prices, they've switched to things like coal.
Yep.
So it's created demand for coal, which, by the way, is up about 3 times since the start of the year in terms of the price of thermal coal. But that's also caused more CO2 to be emitted, which has created an escalating carbon price because more people want to buy those carbon offsets because they're generating more CO2. And so the carbon price has almost doubled in Europe over this year because of this situation. It's just crazy, all these different effects.
Well, there's
right?
sort of perfect storm effects. For example, in the UK, the wind wasn't blowing all that much, and they've got all that offshore wind capacity. So the combination of high gas prices, not as much wind power being generated, actually forced the UK to fire up some more coal plants, just as like you said, and they're firing up more in China. And it's creating a negative transition. The higher prices for carbon are likely to dampen demand, but ultimately all of it is likely to funnel right through the supply chain straight to the consumer in terms of higher all the way to grocery prices, commodity prices for durable goods, et cetera, et cetera. And these are the inflationary forces that people are now talking about.
Right. Yeah, that was our podcast last week. Mm-hmm. And even crazy things like people switching to oil for power generation, which is kind of unheard of because it's too expensive generally.
Yeah.
Now, this is mostly happening in Asia, but somewhat in Europe as well. So that's potentially going to cause more demand for oil than people were thinking. Now, the demand is responding. The market does work, like you say. We've seen China have these rotating power blackouts. And we've seen manufacturers in Europe say they're actually going to cut back. Like, for example, a major fertilizer company shutting down two UK plants. So demand is going to respond because that price isn't sustainable. But when it comes to heat, you know, it's very tough to respond. You know, people need heat. And there's been real concerns, especially in China, on their equivalent of Twitter, their social media, about people very concerned about what it's going to be like this winter if they're having these electrical blackouts and people don't have heating. Many of them have been forced to go onto electrical heat to get off coal. So when that power goes out, are they going to have no heat in the winter?
Yeah, well, that's the ultimate an amenity deficit, I'll call it, because people are already grumpy that they're all having to pay more for groceries and things as a consequence of all this. And the anticipation is by Christmas time, it's going to cost even more for goods. But if you get into the territory of being cold and having to queue up for your energy supplies, I mean, that's when people get really, really upset.
Yeah. All right. So it's quite a mess. But let's talk about a few more issues that are kind of interesting related to energy security, because I think that will tie into our takeaways. So there was power issues in the UK, apparently, as well. Not only do they have the very high natural gas prices and the high power prices because the natural gas price is going up, but also there's been a shortage by a major cable being cut that feeds electricity into the UK. So that's caused something like a 2 gigawatt of capacity, which is a significant amount of capacity. Their total capacity is 85 gigawatts, has been cut off for a good part of this winter probably.
Yeah. It just, again, speaks to supply chain vulnerability. And on that note, I think it's important also to talk about the geopolitical situation because, say, the overlay on top of all this, geopolitics is nothing new, but the Russians are reportedly constraining some of those gas supplies, the natural gas supplies, because they're a big one, because, of course, they want to see their Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline approved. And this is a big lever that they have. And it's interesting now that, as I said earlier, that we have globalized our North American natural gas supplies, which on one hand is good, but on the other hand, we are now no longer shielded from geopolitical issues on the other side of the planet. And especially with our historical rivals, the Russians, and certainly they're not in any happy mood given all the sanctions and restrictions and things that we've imposed on them.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting. Russia has not increased their production through all of these high prices. Now, the story is that they also have low storage and they need to provide the gas domestically. However, you just don't know what's behind that. But usually, typically, if we saw prices at this level in the past, you would have seen some increase of supply from Russia. Hopefully, with Nord Stream 2 coming on, we'll see some more growth in their production into Europe. That's what I'm sure the Europeans are hoping for.
Yeah.
And that's expected to happen at the end of this year. But you're right. They have all the cards here, don't they, in terms of people not having a lot of options outside of their gas in Europe.
They're a huge gas producer and the world's largest oil producer. And so if we are exposed to those international market realities, then we are also exposed to the international geopolitical realities.
All right. Well, let's talk about, that's one lesson right there. We're more exposed to these things. But let's talk about some lessons that come out of all of this when it comes to energy security and the energy transition. The first one is, I think we should all expect more volatility because it's becoming clear that we have less supply cushion than we used to. So situations like this, when they happened in the past, you know, we would get a supply response. Today, there's a lot of different factors here. For instance, uncertainty about long-term demand is causing oil and gas companies to invest less in supply. And for at least some of these countries that aren't increasing their LNG supply and are operating below their nameplate capacity, part of it is a lack of investment. So they're not able to supply more gas when situations like this occur. And as investors are putting more and more pressure on these companies to not grow, I think we're going to have a much more narrow supply cushion, which is going to create more situations like this.
Well, I think, yeah, you could also look at it from the perspective of the divestment movement, the ESG movement, and the clamps that have been put on the, I'll call it, Western oil and gas producers. As you just said, they have been given the directive to not grow their output, which suits the Russians, the Saudis, and the OPEC members just fine, because it's basically taken out a competitor. And so guess what? When demand came roaring back, President Biden picks up the phone to OPEC, I think it's twice now, asking to have more supply come from them. And I think the most recent one, which was only like a day or two ago, the OPEC ministers basically said, I think we're just fine. And of course they are. I mean, they've realized that having taken out a competitor and by constraining output by just a few percent, the price of their commodity goes up by multiple percent.
Yeah, well, and we're not seeing the supply response. Like, you know, no. Interesting enough, North America, this was my example, in 2014, when we saw gas prices in the range of what we've seen over the last several months, we saw about a 5 BCF per day year-on-year increase on average, and that's a 7% growth in supply. Mm-hmm. But we're not seeing anything, and no one's expecting that because most of the companies that produce in North America today have told their shareholders they're going to give money back in terms of dividends or pay down debt. They're not going to grow their supply. And in some of these countries that were LNG suppliers, like Nigeria, they're not investing like they were before, and they've been on the record saying part of it is because they haven't been investing. So I just think we're going to see a lot more volatility in a world where when anything goes wrong, you know, we don't have that excess spare capacity that we used to have. I think one lesson is companies, consumers, investors should be thinking about a more volatile commodity price environment than what we've experienced in the past and what that would mean for their companies and their businesses.
I think so. I think it's definitely more volatile. And I think that, you know, the lesson, getting back to the UK petrol or gasoline situation, is that there could be knock-on effects from even policy. Like the shortage of gas and diesel at gas stations was not caused by any shortage of oil or any shortage of gasoline. It was caused by a shortage of drivers that drive the trucks from the refinery to the gas stations. And that was a direct consequence of the Brexit policy, where a lot of the European, largely East European drivers basically left the UK to go back home because of the Brexit policies. And so you say, well, okay, that has nothing to do with energy shortages in terms of shortage of supply. But I would argue, though, that it shows how knock-on effects of one kind of policy can affect the vulnerability of a supply chain.
Yeah, it's that unintended consequences.
Yeah, there's sort of these unintended consequences you weren't necessarily thinking about. And so, you know, one of the things that I think we need to be watching is that there's labor shortages starting to emerge in the upstream of oil, right? So similar to labor shortages in terms of the truck drivers who drive your trucking around, you know, there's shortages now that are being documented in the U.S. oil fields because there's competition for labor. People have exited the business. So there's just, you know, even if you want to drill more wells, you can't. And that there's competition in the oil field service business. There's wage inflation. So, you know, the cost of everything's going up. And there's sort of these knock-on effects that potentially we need to be thinking about down the road. Because, you know, one of the things about this energy transition is that everybody thinks, okay, it's going to be a smooth transition. We'll get off oil and we're going to get onto renewables and it's all going to be very seamless. Much like, say, when you get rid of your DVD player and start streaming video. Well, it's not going to work that way because the demand side of the oil business is not slowed down. It's actually picked up. And there really has not been any transition off oil at a time when supplies are starting to show stress and strain and vulnerability.
Yeah. I think there's been a lot of thinking about 2050 here and not much about the next several years and forgetting that we're not off hydrocarbons yet. The world still consumes about 80% of all primary energy comes from hydrocarbons.
Yeah.
And we still need some investment in them. So this is another point. That was a great one. So that's the third one would be, I look at this and think, well, I think some of the investors and ENGOs are probably barking up the wrong tree right now. So they're spending a lot of the time working on convincing people to divest from oil and gas, thinking we need to cut off supply. So there's some recent examples like the Harvard divestment of fossil fuels that made a lot of news. And there's been other major pension funds or foundations announce their divestment recently. And that's been a trend for many years. And then on top of that, even the investors that stay invested in the oil and gas companies have worked with groups like Climate Action 100 Plus to convince oil and gas companies like BP to reduce their production and put more and more of their cash flow into new energy. And, you know, they're doing this with good intentions. They're saying, you know, we have to deal with the climate issue, and so we need to stop supplying the oil and gas. However, that isn't going to do it. As we can see, if you cut off the supply but you don't cut off the demand, you're going to create all this volatility. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to work against their intentions. It's going to create backlash. Like this winter, people in Europe aren't going to be quite as happy about a green agenda if they think it's going to mean that their power bill goes up 7 times and they're cold in the winter.
Well, there already is a lot of questioning about the green agenda because the prices have already gone up and it's not even winter yet. And I think you're right. There can be a backlash because, you know, when you get into that territory of discomfort, then you start thinking about yourself, as is evidenced by the hoarding that went on over the last couple of weeks of people queued up largely unnecessarily by all accounts to the gas station. And so they're not thinking about energy transition or climate or anything. They're thinking about themselves. And when people get grumpy, it's not good politically. It's not good. It doesn't serve any purpose. And, you know, further to your point about good intention, okay, I agree it has good intention, but what should be the intention? What is the intention? What is the imperative? The imperative is to reduce emissions as fast as possible without inconveniencing the public, the citizenry, as we go forward. And so we can put together pathways to reduce emissions from oil and gas and the whole energy complex in a way that doesn't do this. But merely targeting supply and choking it off and creating inflation and vulnerabilities and geopolitical overlays and so on, I think is not well thought through.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Well,
we're seeing that real time now. But, you know, these investors, to me, here's something more constructive that would be more successful. Why don't they focus on everything it would take to get electric cars to really take off? So helping to build out the infrastructure, which is going to be our next podcast, is how the infrastructure is a huge barrier for the adoption of EVs, and doing things to promote people to buy EVs and to reduce the demand so that the oil companies, they sure enough will reduce their production when demand isn't there. That's for sure going to happen. Mm-hmm. But to do it the other way around, to cut off supply when demand is still there, is going to create all this volatility and potential for backlash.
Yeah, I think so. It's not a good situation. And if it's a cold winter, it is going to resonate all the way back to here. And I think that we need to be concerned about how to think more holistically about the energy transition so that it doesn't create undue cost inflation. It doesn't create undue hardship for people, in the worst case, being very cold in the winter. And think about, at the same time, the best ways to reduce emissions as quickly as possible.
With that, we'll wrap it up. This is a real-time example about how interconnected our world is. We all forget that when it comes to energy, whether it be different energy types, like gas being connected to coal and to oil, but also geographically connected because the price in Europe is affecting other regions in the world as
well. Yeah, you know, it's interesting, just a closing comment, is that as a consequence of the pandemic, we're seeing a lot of deglobalization, in other words, repatriation of our supply chains, whether it's for vaccines or food or computer chips and so on and so forth. But in energy, certainly from our North American perspective, we're actually seeing greater globalization. And by doing that, we are becoming more vulnerable to global dynamics and vagaries in the geopolitics and so on that we discussed.
Thank you for joining this podcast. If you like this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.